Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. You might not know this by listening to the news, but even more people are taking to the streets to resist Trump's second term compared to his first. According to the Crowd Counting Consortium at Harvard, protests are growing at an impressive pace. These are protests in all 50 states, including in deep red parts of the country. Last Thursday on May Day, 250,000 people took to the streets in nearly 1,000 cities and towns to stand up to Trump and demand a country that works for families, not billionaires. And that 250,000 number is according to May Day Strong. The massive day of protests came just after Trump marked his 100th day in office, which, according to Time Magazine's Eric Cortalesa, have been among the most destabilizing in U.S. history, a blitz of power grabs, strategic shifts, and direct attacks that have left opponents, global counterparts, and even many supporters stunned. A senior Trump official said, "Our success depends on his ability to shock you." Trump's approval rating is at just 40%, the lowest of any president at this time in the past 80 years, according to the Pew Research Center, as polls show a growing opposition to Trump's extreme policies, but no electoral opportunity for voters to demonstrate their dissatisfaction until 2026. Activists are leading the way in the fight against Trump's agenda. So what is most effective, and how are activists preparing for the many fights to come? If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on the most effective ways to resist Trump's agenda? If you have been involved in protests or rallies, what are you hearing from people? We're seeing on social media that a lot of older people are coming out for the very first time. What do you think is most effective, and how are you and friends and everyday people preparing for the many fights to come? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by three activists. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible, an organization that was founded in response to Trump's Electoral College victory back in 2016. More than a million members are working to resist the GOP's agenda, elect local leaders, and fight for progressive policies. Ezra Levin is co-author of the 2019 book, We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. Hi, Ezra. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. Sonika Mahajan is Director of Community Engagement and Organizing for Mission Action, an immigrant, tenant, and workers' rights organization in San Francisco's Mission District. Hi, Sonika. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Saul Levin is Campaigns and Political Director for the Green New Deal Network, a coalition of organizations across the labor, climate, and justice movements united in the fight to win a full-scale Green New Deal by the year 2030. Hi, Saul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be on with you. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's great to have all of you. So much has happened over the past 100 days. We are doing shows on policies on Wednesday. We're also going to talk again about Project 2025. I just want to start by asking you all, what really stands out for you so far, given that so much has happened? Ezra, let's start off with you. What has stood out for you?
Well, look, we lived through the first Trump administration, and we saw his incredibly unpopular agenda pushed forward, but it was pushed forward largely through the traditional mechanisms. This is through somewhat normal executive actions and through a legislative process that didn't succeed in doing everything he wanted, but did succeed in some. He tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He failed. He tried to pass major tax cuts for billionaires, and he succeeded. This Trump administration has not been the same. I would view it as categorically different. What it resembles more than a traditional right-wing government is a authoritarian breakthrough, is how I would describe it. And in an authoritarian breakthrough, what you see is an attack on the pillars of liberal democracy that would normally uphold our system of law and order. So that means attacks on businesses, on law firms, on universities, attacks on civil society, on nonprofits. That is, at least at the extent that we're seeing it now, new. And in response to those attacks, we're seeing quite a bit of co-optation, cooperation, collaboration from those entities that should be upholding democracy. So media, business, big law, tech, billionaires, higher education, we've seen a lot of them fall to the threats of this authoritarian bully. Now, on the bright side, while we have seen these institutions fall, we've seen this historic level of engagement. You talked about the Harvard study of mass numbers of people coming out. That's what I'm seeing on the ground right now. And I've been seeing it since November. We are experiencing a wave moment of grassroots enthusiasm and organizing, people who have never been engaged before, people who were engaged, dropped off, and are now getting re-engaged. And that is the silver lining in this moment. While some institutions are falling, people are standing up and acting as the bulwark for democracy. And our hope in this moment is that organized people power that has been growing week after week, month after month, will be enough to safeguard the democracy from further attacks.
And to your point, these actions are not getting as much media attention as many think they deserve. And the researchers at Harvard have pointed out so many mass protests, March 4th for Democracy, Stand Up for Science on March 7th, International Women's Day, March 8th, National Park Workers, Resistance Rangers, March 22nd, National Association of Letter Carriers Fight Like Hell rallies, March 23rd, Tesla takedown protests, March 29th, and then protests against ICE, against the detentions of Mahmoud Khalil, for example, and many others. There's so many protests that the researchers at Harvard have laid out.
That's right. And that is so important. What we know from the experts in creeping authoritarianism, and this is Erica Chenoweth, who is one of the authors of the Harvard work, but also Timothy Snyder and Heather Cox Richardson, among others, is that if you are living through a period of creeping authoritarianism, when institutions are falling, what you are seeing is not some sort of experience of institutions acting irrationally. They are acting rationally. They look at the conditions on the ground, they look at the political reality, and they say to themselves, this guy's an autocrat. This guy is consolidating power. That is the new reality. Therefore, we must be cowed. Therefore, we must give in to the bullying. But when you have mass organized peaceful protest around the country, what that does is shifts their time horizon. Instead of making decisions based on the current reality existing forever, what having millions of people peacefully protesting against authoritarian takeover does is it shifts them to think about the next era, the 2027, when Democrats will control the House and can engage in accountability, the 2029, when Trump will be out of office and we will have a new era of accountability. Those institutions, be it law firms or universities or businesses, will still be law firms and universities and businesses in that future era. We want them thinking about that future reality and contending with the fact that they are going to have to deal with how they behave now. And I don't want them falling now. I want them seeing the writing on the wall. This guy is an unpopular, lame duck president trying to push through a deeply popular agenda and to concentrate power within the White House. But that's short term. It's not going to work because the people aren't going to accept it. That's the message we send every week we show up in a peaceful way to demonstrate the people aren't with this guy.
Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible. We're also joined by Sonika Mahajan, director of community engagement and organizing for Mission Action. And Sonika, when you were on Thursday to talk about these May Day protests, we talked a bit about how protests have already shifted some of Trump's extreme policies. You were instrumental in organizing the May Day protest, one of the May Day protests in San Francisco. What can you tell us about the priorities of people who participated and what you heard from everyday people on the streets?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like you said, Rose, Trump and the right wing are really using the flood the zone strategy to try to overwhelm us, attacking workers' rights on really all fronts, mass layoffs in the public sector, trampling on due process and free speech, cracking down on opposition and protests, and of course, deportations and detentions that are really illegal. So I think what they're trying to do is scare us or overwhelm us into not being able to respond to any of these. So what May Day was really saying is that we, as the working class and the immigrants in San Francisco and the Bay Area, we realize that all of our struggles are really connected and they can't be divided up. And we're resisting the strategy of trying to make us fearful or trying to divide us up along lines of immigration status or really any other line. And we came together as workers across all sectors, across all national backgrounds, to stand up not only against the Trump right-wing agenda, but also the billionaires that are scraping profits off of our back and the system that makes all of this possible. And not only do we need to defeat the attacks from the Trump administration, but we're also fighting for a future where workers are in charge. Workers run the economy here, and the economy should run for workers. So that was really the message of May Day here in San Francisco. And it was a really important moment for us because labor and community organizations came together and stood shoulder to shoulder in the streets and very much showed that we will not be divided as a working class, no matter how much they try, and that we won't back down no matter how fearful they try to make us. And I think there's so many examples of ways that the Trump administration is trying to intimidate those who might oppose their policies, the detentions of people like Mahmoud Khalil and others who were protesting for Palestine and against the genocide, even though they had green cards or other legal documentation. But really, the working class here in San Francisco and all the workers and immigrants were in the streets anyway, saying, we're not going to back down. We're not afraid. And we know that the only way that we can really protect ourselves and defend ourselves against these attacks on an ongoing, long-term basis is to stand together and get in the streets, essentially. And that backing down or being silent won't protect us.
And like I said, we're going to spend more time talking about specific policies on Thursday. But one that I've been following because it affects so many of us whose loved ones have been affected by cancer. Senator Tammy Baldwin put out a press release recently that exposes the Trump administration for stopping $47 million from treatment for cancer patients. I mean, they're just going after so much. And 47 million is really pennies when you think about how much money the federal government spends. And then ProPublica, we were going to cover this on Friday, but we'll cover it again. The Trump administration's war on children, the staff of a program that helps millions of poor families keep the electricity on, in part so that babies do not die from extreme heat or cold, have all been fired. There's just so much when you drill down. Saul, what would you like to add? I mean, you're focusing on winning a Green New Deal, and we've done so many shows about the need to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. I mean, this is just going to get worse under Trump. What stands out for you when you look back over the past 100 or so days?
Thanks, Rose. Yeah, I mean, so many things stand out. But one of the things that I think is really important is that we're trying to start with understanding. When we see the Trump administration propose illegal drilling on certain public lands where that's not permitted, when we see them trying to gut the EPA, for us, the first step is understanding, I think, something that Ezra highlighted, which is that this is very different from the first Trump administration. And you hear a lot of people in the environmental movement and just in general say, wow, this is so unprecedented. We can't believe that they're doing this. It seems so random. And a lot of our work in the environmental community and more broadly right now has been helping people understand that this actually isn't unprecedented if you look at the whole world. Elon Musk and Donald Trump and their sort of cronies are following the authoritarian playbook of how to take over a democracy and dismantle basic freedoms to a T. I mean, some of the democracy researchers that we work with have been able to predict what they're going to do a full week in advance because they're so much following this playbook of how do you subvert freedoms? How do you take over a democracy? And so a lot of our work, as we're resisting and protesting and all of these things, is identifying that so we can understand what's happening in this moment in the context of history across the world. And there was a really, amazing research study that was published last year by someone named Jonathan Pinckney and another researcher named Claire Trilling that demonstrated that when you have an organized movement of resistance, as opposed to when you don't, you're much more likely as a nation to stop democratic, backsliding or, creeping towards authoritarianism. And so when we're thinking about environmental issues, we're not thinking them as isolated, but we're thinking about how, an attack on and surveillance of EPA workers or workers at the Department of Energy who make sure that people are safe in their homes and have good insulation, who make sure that the air and water that we breathe and drink are clean. An attack on them is also an attack on every person in this country who benefits from that clean air and water. And so instead of seeing it in isolation, we think about the Serbian dictatorship, right? When, Milosevic, the dictator in Serbia, took over, he began with what he called the anti-bureaucratic revolution. And he went after federal workers because they're so fundamentally important to upholding a democracy. And he thought, if I can get rid of all of the people who do work for our civilians, all of the people who prevent corruption and will call me out if I'm lying and stealing, then no one will be able to call me out anymore from the inside, and I'll be able to do whatever I want. And so when we're fighting back in the environmental movement, we're thinking about it as actually a labor issue, an immigrant rights issue, a democracy issue, and a general people's issue to help folks understand this isn't actually unprecedented. It's just unprecedented in America because for hundreds of years, even if different aspects of our democracy have faltered at different moments, we haven't had a full-blown authoritarian takeover of this scale and of this type. And so it's incumbent upon us to understand that and really slow them down.
So this is interesting. It makes me think that we should have people on from different countries to talk about how they have stood up to authoritarians. For example, in Hungary, I just think about CPAC having their conference in Hungary a couple of years ago, and at the time, I wondered why that didn't get more media attention. What are you learning, Saul, from activists in other countries who have been through this?
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned that. That's one of our big focuses. I mean, you look at how South Korea prevented an authoritarian takeover with civil resistance, how judicial resistance of the judges in Poland stopped a political takeover by the far right of the court system. We look at similar resistances in Brazil from a little further back. And what we're learning is that no one ever knows exactly how to stop an authoritarian takeover right when it happens. Even if you don't like Trump or you do and you're listening in, right? None of us thought or knew exactly all of the insane and illegal stuff that him and his team were going to do, far beyond any, sort of conservative policy, just doing blatantly illegal stuff. And so one of the things we've learned from abroad that has really stuck with us and informed our organizing is that we're not going to know exactly how to stop this, takeover in the first days or weeks. But what we can do is slow it down. And so when we have thousands, if not millions, of people protesting day after day, there were massive protests on Earth Day. 50,000 people in New York City came together to protest violations of immigrant rights and environmental rights in New York City a few days before Earth Day. These are the kind of things that can help slow it down. And so when we talk to people in other countries, we learn about the frameworks and we can understand. Instead of being confused, we can recognize their strategy and actually use that as fodder for coming up with better resistance to protect our freedoms and rights. And actually, the way that I spent May Day was that we organized a training in collaboration with the 50501 movement. For people who couldn't go out in the streets. So a lot of the folks that we trained, we've been training hundreds of people on how to fight back against authoritarianism based on international examples. And a lot of folks, because of family situations, disability, et cetera, couldn't make it out. And so we were providing trainings based on Hungary, Serbia, South Korea, Guatemala, you name it, so that people can understand what's going on and then add their own brilliance to try and slow this down and eventually stop it.
Wow. And for people who are not familiar with this, the 50501 movement is 50 protests, 50 states, one movement. It's interesting to hear about this, Saul. Just quickly, can you tell us what are you hearing from people who cannot make it out to the streets? What kind of organizing are you doing with these people? I have not heard of this. I haven't seen much of this in the media at all.
Yeah, well, you know, we're helping people understand the context because Republican, Democrat, Independent, most people in this country do not want a corrupt government. Most people want to be able to get health care and Social Security for themselves and their families. Most people in this country want the national parks to be kept intact and to be able to receive medicine and mail from the Postal Service. And so what we're seeing is if we can give people frameworks about how this has happened in different types of political contexts around the world, people can have actually be ready to talk to their neighbors. And so we're encouraging folks to find unlikely bedfellows and form alliances with people they didn't know or don't usually work with to talk about this and actually start to build bridges. Because what it really comes down to, despite our differences or which team we root for or what our exact political take is that most people in the United States do not want an authoritarian government. Most people want to be able to gather in public spaces and maintain their privacy. And so this is a lot of what we talk about with folks. And, you know, it's really, you know, the reason we do it is a lot of it's after hours. You know, we have volunteers running trainings is because we want people to see their own power. This is not over. This is not an authoritarian country, and we refuse to let it get there. But if we don't resist and share information, it's going to be really hard. And so part of what we're doing is trying to contest a fragmented media market and despair and apathy that people feel and give them tools from these other countries to be able to both understand and then fight back and help slow this down.
Well, to your point, I just found a piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, wheelchairs and walkers won't stop these seniors from taking a stand against Trump. This is a senior center in Midtown Atlanta. Mary Beth Thomas, 84, uses a wheelchair. Some have auditory or visual impairment, like Fowler Bush, 84, who is nearly blind. And they're working on making signs and writing letters for protesters out on the streets. So there's so much happening out there. I'm just reading from a couple other headlines. CBS seniors rally in San Bruno to protest Trump policies and defend the social safety net. It seems like there's the big thinking about, you know, learning from other countries and people who've been through this. But then you've got some of the most vulnerable people in our society. And that's what I think about a lot, Sonica. So I'm reading from the Washington Post here. In March, the administration cut $1 billion from Department of Agriculture programs that provide food to schools and food banks and said there would be future cuts. Some of those cuts have kicked in. Some are unfolding. It's triggered alarm through the sprawling network of aid groups that provide free or very low-cost food to millions of struggling Americans every week. And then ProPublica has a piece about how House Republicans are planning a major SNAP food aid overhaul in Trump's mega bill. So what are your thoughts about what needs to happen to make sure people have their basic needs met? Because that's just going, I mean, it was already hard. It's just going to get harder under Trump.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Rose. It's been really hard to afford basic essentials like housing and groceries for working families in this country for many years now. And that definitely didn't start under Trump. It has definitely been getting harder and harder for working people and families to make ends meet and live a decent life. And that's kind of true regardless. And I think we have to think also about how that's been the case locally here in San Francisco. I mean, we're seeing the mayor reinstate a limit for the length of stay for families living in shelters. A couple of families with elementary school age children in SFUSD were nearly evicted a couple months ago, if not for the stout organizing of community organizations that defended them. And they were immigrant families as well. And we're seeing that the city of San Francisco is bending to companies like Uber and Airbnb that are demanding tax cuts and basically holding hostage over $100 million each in city money that could be going to funding services just like what you're talking about, funding our food programs here in San Francisco, funding immigrant rights programming, funding Muni, which is facing cuts. And public transit is what families use to get to and from work and school, and they rely on that. So we have to think about not only how the federal government right now is enacting the agenda of the billionaires and destroying the rights of working class people and making it even harder to live here, but also how that's happening locally, and to make those connections, and to remember that not only are we uniting across all of these sectors to fight back against the attacks from the Trump administration, but also to prevent us from going back to a status quo that was unsustainable in the first place, right? Like, it is becoming harder and harder for families and working people to live in this country and to have their basic essentials, whether that be food or healthcare or housing. But that was also true before. And so we're fighting for more than just defeating these attacks. We're fighting to not go back to the status quo. And that was really true on May Day as well. You're hearing people speak and also chant and in the streets talking about a future where the workers really are in charge of what happens and not the billionaires, no matter who is in the presidency. And I think that's really, really important because it is really critical that we understand the attacks from Trump and understand how they're flooding the zone and trying to overwhelm us and resist that. It's also critical that we don't allow people to be distracted by just that and remind them that this is something that we're fighting regardless of who's in office. And that's true May Day, and it's true beyond as well.
And for people who are wondering about what you said regarding shelters, just because there's so much going on, I found this piece at Mission Local from April 17th. Right now, 344 families are living in San Francisco homeless shelters and trying to get into stable housing. The vast majority of them are immigrants and recent arrivals to the U.S. Since last December, they've been panicking. The city has started to enforce its 90-day cap on shelter, which was suspended during COVID. Families can get an extension every 30 days, but face eviction if it's not granted. And that prompted Supervisor Jackie Fielder to introduce legislation expanding shelter stays to a full year. So we'll have to do a show about that. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the most effective ways to resist Trump's extreme agenda. According to the Crowd Counting Consortium at Harvard, protests are growing at an impressive pace. There are protests in all 50 states, including in deep red parts of the country. More people are taking to the streets to resist Trump's second term compared to his first. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think is most effective? If you've gone to any rallies or protests, what has stood out to you? What is different this time around? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible. Sonika Mahajan is director of community engagement and organizing for Mission Action. And Saul Levin is campaigns and political director for the Green New Deal Network. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht will discuss his new book, My Brother's Keeper, The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. He says the healthcare system, the mental health care system in the U.S. is atrocious, but it's functioning as intended, providing profits for corporations. What will it take to change the system? And then on Thursday, we'll continue once again our series on Project 2025 by talking about Trump's extreme policies. Today, we're talking about the most effective ways to resist Trump. There are even more protests taking place during this term compared to his first term. And if you'd like to join us, what do you think is most effective at this time? What stands out for you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Saul Levin is campaigns and political director for the Green New Deal Network. Sonika Mahajan is director of community engagement and organizing for Mission Action. Ezra Levin is co-founder and co-executive director of Indivisible and author of We Are Indivisible, A Blueprint for Democracy After Trump. So Ezra, given what you've heard from Saul and Sonica, and given how different this time around is, what do you think is most effective, given that we're just in the beginning stages of this?
Yeah, I like that Saul mentioned the fight against Milosevic, OPOR, which was a grassroots Laftivism-based movement. In Serbia was instrumental in resisting authoritarianism and ultimately taking down the authoritarian. Lessons that we've learned from historical fights and global fights against authoritarianism are really influencing our strategic decisions now. And what we've learned from them is, one, you got to build a broad coalition. We are not all going to agree on what a democratic unified government in 2029 ought to do. That's okay. Broad-based movements against authoritarianism actually don't need to agree on what their proactive policy agenda will be when they're back in power. What they need to agree on is that they don't want a king, that they don't want an authoritarian. And so welcoming in to your pro-democracy movement people who you strongly disagree with on many policy issues is smart and effective, and in fact the only thing that has worked to effectively take down authoritarians who are trying to consolidate power. Another very important lesson that we've learned from fights in America against authoritarianism, for instance in the Deep South, and fights against authoritarianism internationally, is the importance of waging nonviolence. This is really crucial because there is nothing an authoritarian likes more than the opportunity to crack down on organized protest. And if you give them that opportunity by engaging in any kind of property destruction or violence, they will take it. They will take it and they will use that as an opportunity to consolidate their power further. So these two, there are other lessons, but these two ideas, one, building an ideologically diverse coalition for the current moment, not one that's necessarily going to stick with you for decades to come, but for the current moment that is firmly pro-democracy and can agree on saying no to creeping authoritarianism. And two, working with that broad-based movement to wage nonviolence. Those are driving the strategies and tactics that we're engaging in now. Just yesterday, we announced the next global day of protest. It's going to be on June 14th. We're calling it No King's Day, and we're calling it that because Donald Trump just confirmed his intent to spend tens of millions of taxpayer dollars on his birthday for a military parade through the streets of D.C. This is not something you would normally see in America or any kind of constitutional republic, a birthday military parade celebration for the dear leader. We don't stand for that, and I don't believe there are very many Americans who stand for that. So rather than organize counter-protests in Washington, D.C., we're going to be organizing literally everywhere but Washington, D.C. On April 5th, for the hands-off protest, we got out about 3.5 million people all across the globe. I think this is going to be even bigger. I think there are going to be folks in 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 protests all around the world saying no to kings on that day and doing it with folks who they don't necessarily agree with on everything, but doing it in a peaceful, nonviolent way to demonstrate the people are against autocracy. That kind of action allows you to build the biggest possible pro-democracy opposition. And what it does is sends a signal to elected officials and institutions, again, that this period will end, that the creeping authoritarianism will not succeed, will not consolidate power, and is not the new normal, that this is a democratic republic and it will remain a democratic republic after the autocrats lose power.
We're getting a few emails about this military parade. One listener, Sandy, writes, how much is this going to cost? NBC is reporting that it's going to cost $45 million with individual army units bearing the cost of the parade. So $45 million for this, and yet they're cutting $47 million for critical cancer treatments. at 9 National Cancer Institute centers across the country. And, you know, a number of people are just saying, what's going to happen on June 14th? What if he gives a parade and nobody comes? So we have that remark from Sandy. We've got a couple of other emails. Art writes in, I believe the protests must grow and will grow as the economy declines, along with Trump's popularity, and opinion polls show his numbers are dropping, and must gain new, broader participation and begin to build a movement toward impeachment of Trump and eventually others in his administration. Susie writes, seniors at Merrill Gardens on Broadway and 51st in Oakland protest every 2 weeks. There's also seniors in Mill Valley who take to the streets every week to protest. The Marin Independent Journal had a piece recently about them celebrating 20 years of activism. They started when the U.S. invaded Iraq. You know, but we have to also talk about the fact that I'm looking at the numbers, 77 million people still voted for this. I mean, they knew what he was about. Family separation, January 6th, Project 2025. It couldn't get clearer. So 77.3 million people voted for this. Saul, what are your thoughts about how we should be thinking about that?
Yeah, thanks, Rose. You know, I actually would push back a little bit there. I don't think that those tens of millions of people voted for what Donald Trump is doing right now. We've seen a lot of polls that, in fact, a lot of people didn't believe some of the things that he was saying. And, you know, Trump tends to be bombastic and say all kinds of things. And, you know, we don't really believe, like, what we've seen from the polling is that a lot of people voted for him. People didn't really think he was going to do this. And even some of his supporters, and many of them, some of whom I know, have come out and said, you know, we wanted a conservative agenda, or we wanted a new direction, or we're tired of establishment politics. We did not want healthcare for seniors to be cut. We didn't want anyone to attack, you know, Head Start programs in our communities. We didn't want an onslaught on public education and a, you know, king telling people what books their kids can read. And so I would first say I think we need to reach out to people who may have supported Trump and actually push back against the idea that, you know, 70 plus million people voted for this kind of behavior, and instead say, you know, we might have differences, but all kinds of people all over the country are seeing what they're doing to immigrants, what they're doing to due process, and saying, you know, even if we disagree, even if we don't know some of these people, we're not okay with this basic treatment of people. We love living in, you know, a lot of people are saying to us, we love living in the United States because we didn't have to worry about totalitarian surveillance. We didn't have to worry in the same ways about this kind of repression. Of course, some communities have dealt with horrible repression in this country before. So a lot of people have ideas and skills and the expertise of experience to offer. But we're really actually trying to reach out to folks, regardless of who they voted for, and say, hey, I think probably, you know, none of us want a king. None of us want authoritarian rule, and we're not going to obey the illegal orders that they tell us to do in advance. When they try and crack down on free speech, we're not going to keep exercising our rights in the Constitution, because we believe that those are going to stick around, and we're not going to just let them go.
I just found a piece in Newsweek. 1 in 4 Trump voters disappointed or regret voting for him. I'm scared. We'll have to do a whole show about this, but I think that speaks to media coverage last year, because I remember specifically, and I just double checked this, Kamala Harris was doing an interview with CBS anchor Nora O'Donnell, and she brought up a possible national abortion ban. And Kamala Harris said, just read Project 2025. And O'Donnell quickly shot back and said, you know, the former president said it's not true, he would veto this, and even almost said he distanced himself from Project 2025. So in some ways, you know, the media, many media outlets, I don't think, went far enough in letting people know how far Trump would go. What are your thoughts about that, Ezra? Because we did a whole series on Project 2025, and we had to ask the guests so many times, this sounds so out of the norm, but this is what they're putting in this project. And the guest said, this is exactly what they're planning to do. It just, a lot of people said that would never happen here. And that's exactly what's happening.
It's real tragic, I got to say, Rose. You know, we named our 2024 electoral program Project 2024 because we were running against Project 2025. We thought it was a real threat. Now, Trump and his allies lied just about every week about Project 2025. They said they didn't know anything about it. They would never implement it. This wasn't their agenda. And of course, immediately upon taking office, that was their agenda. By one measure, we have seen about 40% of the 900-page right-wing document implemented so far. And they are continuing on to push forward this through unilateral executive action and in partnership with the Republican Congress every week, trying to implement more parts of this terrible agenda that they knew was unpopular. And that's why they swore up and down that it wasn't going to be their agenda. But I do want to say one thing. I think we are focusing rightly so on Donald Trump, the man and the autocrat, on the Republicans in Congress who are helping him or refusing to constrain him. But I hope everybody listens to this, understands that when I say Donald Trump isn't a king, I mean that in a pretty practical way. The United States of America has thousands upon thousands of elected officials, from dog catcher way up on to president of the United States. And the way our constitutional republic works is all political power in this country comes from the people. The people then lend out that power to a city council person, a state legislature, a state senator, a mayor, a senator, a U.S. representative, and yes, a president. But the president has some of that power, not all of it. So when we're looking to how do we constrain Donald Trump, how do we stop this creeping authoritarianism, yes, some of the fight is playing out in Congress. Some of the fight is playing out in the courts against unconstitutional and illegal executive orders and actions. But that's not where all the fight is playing out. This year, in 2025, there are 15 Democratic trifecta states, which is a state where there is a Democrat as governor and a Democrat in the state legislature, in control of the state legislature. 15. These states have a choice. They can be entrepreneurial in opposing actively this overreach from the federal government. They can hide and try not to be targeted by creeping authoritarian in the White House, or they can do whatever it is that Gavin Newsom is doing. And I honestly can't really categorize it. He's interviewing right-wingers like Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon. He's declining to go fully on offense in ways that can protect his own residents in the fourth largest economy in the world or provide a safe haven for residents in other states that are under threat. So if you're in California or you're in Maine or you're in New Mexico or you're in Illinois or you're in Washington or you're in Oregon or you're in any one of these Democratic states, by all means, yes, encourage your federal elected officials to fight back if they're in Congress. But also turn an eye to where you have unilateral control, where there should be a unified opposition party, and ask your governor, ask your state legislator, what are you doing to fight back and why aren't you fighting back with everything you've got? I frankly would like to see a lot more J.B. Pritzkers in this country right now than Gavin Newsom's. And I would like to see Gavin Newsom and others like him get the encouragement to start actually fighting back. And the way we get there is by organizing broad-based constituent protest to demonstrate there's political opportunity to go on offense against authoritarianism.
You know, we're getting a few emails about the Democratic Party, and I mean, this can be another hour. I just wonder what your thoughts are on this, Sonica, because a lot of people are wondering, what is the future of the Democratic Party? I mean, you've got Bernie Sanders and AOC out there talking about inequality and poverty and the homeless crisis, as they regularly do. But then you have the other wing of the party that isn't really moving to that, I don't want to say side, but they're not talking about those issues. So you've always had this tension within the Democratic Party. there's the sort of the corporate wing, you know, putting Mark Cuban on stage, for example, at Kamala Harris's events. And then you've got the wing that says we need to put the Poor People's Campaign on stage. So what are your thoughts about the way forward?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think it comes back to the question also about the people that did vote for Trump. First of all, this election was marked by a really sharp turn down in voter turnout compared to even 2020. So yes, Trump won the popular vote, but by a lot fewer votes than his total number in 2020. And of course, also the Democratic Party received 14 million fewer votes than Biden did in 2020. So thinking about the fact that just a lot fewer people turned out to vote for both parties than in previous years, I think there's so many important factors to that. And they have to do with the failure of really both parties to meet people's basic needs. And we've been talking about that, right? Been talking about how really immigration has been a huge struggle in this country for decades. And even those that can manage to stay have a really hard time living and thriving and sending their kids to school and having enough to eat. We've talked about how housing is treated as something to be bought and sold and not a right of people, which in places like San Francisco, we can very clearly see the impacts of the housing crisis on our streets and in our communities. And that really is a fault of the system that allows the billionaires to run our government and not the people, not the way that it should be, not the working class people that are actually running our economy and giving the labor to make everything work in this country. So I think partially, you know, the people that voted for Trump were dissatisfied as well with the Democratic Party and dissatisfied with the system that allows all of this to happen. And to me, the best path forward is building a movement where people are in charge, building an independent movement to fight back. That's kind of how we saw May Day as well, is a progression in a series of escalating protests, both in the Bay Area and nationwide, that not only were fighting back against Trump and refusing to back down or bow to the billionaires' agenda, but also building a coalition between so many different facets of the working class. You know, we talked about labor, we talked about immigrant rights organizations, other community organizations, and build an independent movement to fight back. And people, I think, are looking to alternatives as well, thinking about how they can look outside the two-party system, how they can not rely on any politician within that system really to save us, because we've seen that that is not coming. No one is coming to save us. And for a lot of us, especially our immigrant communities, it's very clear that we have to fight for ourselves. And we have to be the ones to save ourselves and each other. And we can't abandon any worker. We can't abandon any family in that fight. And we refuse to. And I think, you know, the crisis in the Democratic Party that you mentioned is a really important one for us to keep in mind, because even the more progressive elements of the Democratic Party that do want the poor people's agenda at the front and center, they're getting destroyed by other elements of the Democratic Party. And we've seen that in the past too with Bernie's previous campaigns. And so I think really people are thinking about what alternatives they have and how they can build a movement that doesn't rely on the Democratic Party to beat Trump, because we all want to do that, but it's becoming kind of clear to many of us, especially in the immigrant rights communities, that the Democratic Party didn't do a lot of what it could do to protect us from this.
You know, Sonica, thank you for reminding us of this. I just forgot. I've had a tough year with family issues, so I completely forgot about this. Voters in liberal strongholds across the country, this is according to the New York Times, from city centers to suburban stretches, fail to show up to vote for Vice President Kamala Harris at the levels they had for Joe Biden 4 years earlier, contributing significantly to her defeat by Trump. This is according to a New York Times analysis. The decline in key cities, including Detroit and Philadelphia, made it exceptionally difficult for Kamala Harris to win the battlegrounds of Michigan and Pennsylvania. The drop-off is an extraordinary shift for Democrats, who, motivated by Trump's surprise victory, turned out in eye-popping numbers in 2016. But this just didn't happen this time around. Final thoughts from you, Ezra. You have worked on the Hill. How do you think, in our final minute, what are you hearing from Democrats? How are they thinking about this? Just the fact that people just didn't turn out in the numbers that they needed.
Look, you mentioned earlier that Donald Trump's approval rating has dropped to about 40%. And that's worse than any president at this point in his presidency. And also Chuck Schumer, the top-ranking Democrat in Congress, you know what his approval rating is? 17%. 17%. Congressional Democrats have an approval rating in the low 20s. So it is a incredibly important issue that we build a unified opposition party that the public can actually believe in. We don't currently have that. We have a lot of fighters in the Democratic Party, folks like Maxwell Frost and Jamie Raskin and Jasmine Crockett and Chris Murphy, Chris Van Hollen. There's a long list. But as of November, December, January, the dominant theory in the Democratic Party was, and these are in the words of James Carville in a New York Times op-ed, Democrats should roll over and play dead. That is not where rank and file Democrats were, and it's not where a growing number of independents and even moderate Republicans are. If we want to rebuild the Democratic Party into a legitimate political force, we've got to back up the fighters in the party. The fighting faction of the party needs to have our support. That's where the people are, because the people don't want authoritarians. But if you have a large faction of the party saying, hey, we should go along with Trump, we should pass the Laken Riley bill, a MAGA messaging bill on immigration, we should give them the votes for their Republican budget instead of using the leverage we've got, you're not going to give them something to back up, and you're going to continue to lose politically. And worse than that, we might not be able to hold on to our democratic institutions. So again, I come back to this basic argument. If we want a democratic republic to continue, if we want the authoritarian to be stuck in his tracks, we need to organize. We need to organize on the ground. And that's not looking to any national leader to do it for us. We have to organize ourselves. We've got to reach out to our friends and family members and colleagues in our own communities and show up in person, treat democracy as a participatory sport, and make
Well,
clear that we're not victims of events. We're actually agents.
we will definitely continue this conversation. Ezra Levin, Sonika Mahajan, and Saul Levin, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.